On the Bookshelf with your host, Dave Doug Kirby.
We are delighted to welcome back to On the Bookshelf Steve Barry, New York Times best-selling author, with his latest novel, The Atlas Maneuver, a Cotton Malone novel. It's from Grand Central Publishing. The book has some new stuff in it, and some old friends, and some new enemies. So it is an absolutely fascinating read. Steve, thank you so much. I know that we're talking at the end of a whole day of interviewing, so thank you so much for fitting me in, too.
Glad to be here. Glad to talk about it. Let's do it.
One of the major features in the Atlas Maneuver is the new international money system built on Bitcoin. And I think that we could talk for some time about Bitcoin to help people understand, because frankly, most people who are not in high finance jobs might have heard about it, but they don't really know very much about it. And that's a really significant part of this novel.
It is. And that was one of the reasons I wanted to write the novel, is I wanted to educate folks about Bitcoin, because I knew nothing about it when I started this. And I spent 6 months studying it, reading about it, learning all about it. And when you're done reading this novel, you should have a pretty good understanding of how the system works, particularly a flaw in the system that this book really exploits to its fullest, that's real. And so that's one of the purposes of the book, was to educate on the subject of Bitcoin, because it's fascinating. It's very, very fascinating.
So what's the deal with it anyway? It's a type of money that doesn't really exist, and understanding that most money, once upon a time, up until recently, was based on the amount of gold bullion that any nation had in its official archive somewhere. And in our case, it was at Fort Knox for a long, long time. But over time, what we call fiat, that is to say, we have money that is not basing its value on cash, on cash reserves, or on bullion, right?
No. Up until about 1973, 71, 72, yes, money was based on what you had to back it up. If you had $1 billion worth of gold, then you had $1 billion worth of money. That's the way it worked. And you didn't have $2 billion worth of money. You didn't have more money than you had assets to back it up. But that all ended when we came off the gold standard in 1973, and we have now fiat money. Basically, the money is only worth kind of what we want it to be worth. You know, it depends on your belief in the system. You know, money requires a certain belief, a certain faith that this money has value, and that's really what makes it valuable. Bitcoin is the exact same way. Bitcoin's value is determined by what someone else is willing to pay for it. And there's 21 million of them in the world. That's all there will be. Right now there's about 19 million, but there's be 21 million, and that's all. And each coin has a value. And then you can break the coin up. You can sell a tenth of a Bitcoin, a millionth of a Bitcoin, a half of a Bitcoin. You can break them up because it's an electronic entity. But its value is simply decided by what someone else is willing to pay for it. And it's just another form of money that we've had for centuries. You know, gold was a value. Salt once was value. Fish was valuable. Cattle was once traded as money. All kinds of things were money over the course of human existence. We just have a new one now called Bitcoin, created by the internet.
Back in the 1890s, there was one of the best-known orators in America was a Nebraska senator named William Jennings Bryan. And the big speech that he gave at the 1896 Democratic Convention was essentially about not basing the monetary system on just gold, but on gold and silver. And the speech is popularly known and available on YouTube as the Cross of Gold speech. And it won him... got him kind of close to getting the nomination for president, which was his goal, but it was not completely successful. But nowadays, when people read that speech or see it, they think, what was all of that about? I have the feeling that people kind of have that same sense about Bitcoin, that if they haven't dealt with it themselves, they don't really understand it. But
I didn't understand it. I understand the first thing about it. I do now.
Yeah,
I got it. It's a fascinating system that of these coins that are worth what someone else is willing to pay for it, and they're traded by the millions every day, and that's what determines the price, is the trading of the coins and what people are willing to pay for it. And it's its own monetary system. And people may say, well, it's crazy. Well, it's really no different than the money in your wallet, because the money in your wallet has nothing to back it up either.
Right.
There's not one thing backing up the money in your wallet. Zero. It's just your faith in it. You have the faith in that money and the belief that it has value. The Bitcoiners have the exact same thing for theirs. They're literally identical in thought process.
At one point, I remember getting money when I was young, back in the 60s, when I was just a kid. Silver certificates that you could turn in the dollar for its actual...
Absolutely.
Yeah, its actual value in coinage.
They had silver and gold certificates, and that's what paper money was, basically. Is you it was like an IOU from the bank saying, we have this amount of your gold and silver, and when you're ready, you can come back and get it, or anyone who has this in their hand can come back and get it.
Right. It's just more convenient than actually carrying around lumps of gold.
Correct.
Or silver with you.
Bills of exchange is what they called them.
Okay.
And you'll see those silver certificates and gold certificates. And then after a while, that went away. You didn't really go and redeem anything. The bank just held it all for you. And then the money became the value. And then the gold went away, and all went away. And then the money doesn't really have the value. It's now what you believe it to have value is what matters.
Right. I think that's really important for people to know this up front, because I learned an awful lot about Bitcoin by reading this book. And if that is all people got out of it, it would be worth the price of the book. But there's a wonderful story that goes along with it, and Bitcoin becomes a whole part of the negotiation of a bank that really existed once upon a time, but you kind of resurrected it for the purposes of the novel.
Yeah, it was the world's oldest bank. It was created in the 1450s, and it went to 1805. It's called the Bank of St. George. It was in Genoa, Italy. Napoleon ended it in 1805, but in my novel, I just had a move to Luxembourg, and they just kept going.
Right.
And so I just kind of resurrected them and had them up. But it existed for about, 350 years.
Which pretty long time for a bank to hang in there.
Pretty long time. And particularly in the way banks were done in those days, they were, there wasn't anything like the concept of banks that we have today. So it was fun to resurrect it, and then they get caught up with the CIA, and they get caught up in a war with the CIA, and that's where Cotton gets drawn in to the whole thing.
Now, he is a retired operative for a special group, the Magellan Billet, from the Justice Department. But he's the kind of guy that's awfully handy to have on your side. So,
you want Cotton around if you get in trouble. He's the guy you want to. If you're going to be in a foxhole under fire, he's the guy you want to be in the foxhole with you. So, and he gets caught up, and he's doing a favor for a friend, and he gets caught up in this war between these two entities, and he comes face to face with someone from his past that he thought he would never, ever see again, and he has to deal with the emotion of regret, and this is something new for Cotton, and this is the emotion that I explore in this novel with him. Every Cotton Malone book, I explore a different aspect of his personality, and this one is regret.
Yeah.
Going back to things that happened a long, long time ago. And there's a surprise at the end of this book, a surprise that kind of set things up for books to come down the road over the next 2 to 3 years.
Because the things that we do that we later regret still echo into the future.
Yes, they do. And this one comes roaring back when he least expects it.
Yeah.
And just says, here I am. Okay, what do we do? And he's got to deal with it. That was fun for me as a writer to explore that with him.
Right. Is this the 18th Cotton Malone? So you've had a lot of time to develop and round out this character. He's even though I've only been reading the Cotton Malone series for the last 6 or 7 years, I've seen him grow as a human being and start to realize that he may, even if he's capable of doing these kind of missions, he misses the quiet of his little bookstore more and more each time.
He does.
You know, he
wonders why am I doing this? And the answer is simple. He loves it. He loves the rush. He doesn't want to admit that to himself, but he does. And he likes being relevant. He likes being in the thick of things, even though, again, he doesn't want to admit that to himself. And he just gets caught up. And here he gets caught up and drawn in. And once he realizes what's at stake, then he has no choice but to go forward. And then, you know, he has to face so many demons that he thought, well, I'll never see those again. But, yeah, you will. Here they are.
Yep. Now, his girlfriend, Cassiopeia Veit, is involved in this as well. And normally would think we would hope that they would get to be side by side and these sort of things. But as it turns out, that isn't how it always worked out.
Not in this book. You know, yeah. I got them in different locales, but they come together at the end.
Right.
And they're both doing separate things. They thought it was just going to be a few hours, and it turned into a couple of days of things that happen. And so they both are handling it, but from two different angles. I like, you know, Cassiopeia's wonderful. She's a great character. She's been involved in a lot of the stories. And she's going to figure very, very prominently in the next three or four books as Cotton's world gets a little upended. His world's going to change a little bit over the next three or four books.
Yeah, yeah. I sort of see that coming. In case you're just joining us, we're talking to Steve Barry, whose newest Cotton Malone novel is The Atlas Maneuver from Grand Central. And it's got this wonderful world that we're dealing with here in finances that the vast majority of us never really delve into, but we get a chance to learn about it and to see just how important it is in the deeper world. You also have a situation that is based, should we say a legend, or should we say that there is a fair amount of evidence that there was a cache of gold like this.
The Yamashita's gold's real.
Okay.
Yeah, there's no question. The Japanese looted Southeast Asia for 14 years. They had an enormous amount of gold, silver, precious metals, diamonds. They tried to get it all back to Japan, but couldn't. They only got it as far as the Philippines. And General Yamashita was ordered to bury it in the ground, but make sure we could find it. We're going to come back and get it. And he did. It's what he did. Unfortunately, they couldn't come back and find it. The American intelligence community found out about some of it and recovered some of the gold and took it and created something called the Black Eagle Trust and put the money in there and used it to finance covert intelligence operations around the globe. That we know that for a fact, too. We just don't know how much or what they did with the money and whether it still exists or not. All of that's still classified. But all of that's in place. We know Marcos found some of the gold in the 1970s, but the vast majority of the gold's still in the ground. It's still out there waiting to be found.
You know, and this makes sense, because when they conquered a nation, and they conquered a lot of nations in all around the South Pacific Rim, they took control of the banks, and they took control of the money, and in those days, that meant gold bullion reserves and so forth. That was the basis for each of those nations' money.
Yeah, so they stole everything. They were much more prolific looters than the Nazis were, because they had more time to do it.
Right.
And they amassed a lot more wealth than the Nazis ever did. The problem is it just never got back to them. It ended up buried in the Philippines.
Now part of what makes this particular novel interesting is that there are people who are from Japan who are looking for this, whatever is left of it also. With the idea that, hey, you know, we owned it for a while. Who's to say we shouldn't own it some more? And the organization with which they work is an actual organization, too.
Yes, I'd use the Japanese Intelligence Agency to put it together. And they are working with the former emperor. And they're on the look for this gold. But they have another purpose, too, and we can't say what that is, a giveaway in the book, but they have another purpose that comes into play, and everything kind of goes awry when Cotton Malone gets involved, and everything begins to go really, you know, very different than what they thought was going to happen, and that's when it all comes together in the Atlas Mountains, and that's where the climax of the novel takes place, is down there, and that's those scenes that I wrote down there were some of the most unique scenes I've ever written. I've never had scenes like that before with all that happens down there in the Atlas Mountains.
Most people don't realize that after World War II, the United States basically took over Japan and wrote a constitution, imposed rules and regulations on them, and this contributed to them becoming a major economic power by the time of the Korean War, say, when they were now our allies 5 years after we defeated them. But they
We did. We rebuilt Japan, and they were not allowed to have a military, so they became an economic power. And for a long, long time, you know, back in the 60s and 70s, you'd always say, made in Japan, made in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
You know, today you say made in China, but China wasn't in a manufacturing juggernaut then. Japan was that. And they became a huge, you know, economic factor in the world. So all of that's explored in the book, yes, all of it.
Well, and the fact that there were, shall we say, war criminals or people, just like after World War II, there were ex-Nazis that were brought to the United States as part of Operation Paperclip because they had something of value. For example, Wernher von Braun, who headed up essentially all of the rocketing developments in the early days of NASA through the Apollo program, using his old V2s as the starting point, using his scientists and everything. All of these guys got brought over en masse and basically scrubbed of their old background and made shiny new American citizens, and you're working for us now.
Yeah, they did it in Germany, too. They used ex-Nazis to run Germany because the ex-Nazis hated the Soviets.
Right.
And at that point, the Soviets were more of a threat, so the Nazis were essentially used in the government to keep it running, absolutely.
And the same deal goes on in Japan because we've got North Korea starting in 1950, actually a little before that, right? But in 1950 is when they invaded South Korea, but the northern part of the Korean Peninsula, had been communist a year or two longer than that and made no bones about the fact that they wanted to reintegrate South Korea, but they wanted to do it on their own terms, which is to make the entire peninsula a communist state.
And we know for a fact that MacArthur forgave many of the Japanese war criminals because he needed them to help run the country. And he turned his blind eye on a lot of what they did and used them to keep the country running.
Right. And we also captured a lot of scientific papers that just as in Germany that were obtained by scientists doing terrible things to their prisoners of war, and we gained a lot of knowledge from that, even though we weren't the ones doing the terrible things, but we inherited the information and hopefully carried it forward and did good things with it.
One of those dark little secrets that, unfortunately, it was real.
Yeah. Of all the things that you have going on in this book, there are the CIA is one of the main protagonists, if you will, or maybe antagonists. And Cotton has worked with various CIA operatives and bureau chiefs before, and that's how he gets dragged into this situation, right?
Yeah, Derek Coker was in The Last Kingdom, and he dealt with him there, and now he's dealing with him again. So, yes, he gets drugged in because he does a favor for Derek that turns into much, much more. And there's always antagonism between intelligence agencies. It's natural. And the CIA is no exception there. So Malone doesn't really like the CIA very much. And here they're doing some crazy stuff as they normally do, trying to cover up what they had done years ago. And that's where the war comes in between them and the Bank of St. George. And the whole thing just sort of escalates out of control. Cotton gets caught right in the middle of it.
The CIA was formed in the aftermath of World War II, a couple of years afterwards, 47. And a lot of the OSS guys made the transition. But as you point out in the book, this is one of the things I like about your books, that you have an awful lot of history in them that's genuine, that Alan Dulles was the head of the CIA in the early 50s. But they weren't really told what exactly they were supposed to do. Were they just supposed to gather intelligence? Were they supposed to act on the intelligence? And because they had this Black Eagle Fund, they decide to act on the intelligence. And this is the dirty trick stuff.
Well, they had an identity crisis because Truman wanted them to just be an intelligence gathering organization. That's all. They don't do anything more but just gather information. And Dulles wanted them to be like a private army that was offensive and can go out and make things happen and change things. And he ran the CIA that way for a long time. But Dulles was terrible at it. He was terrible at it. The CIA was terrible at it. They made mistake after mistake after mistake. Eventually, Bay of Pigs was the straw that broke the camel's back, and Kennedy fired Dulles and got him out of there. But there was this whole identity crisis going on in the 50s with the CIA that the book deals with that I found very interesting. And this is when the Black Eagle Trust was at its height, and they had all this money available to them that nobody knew about. The question is, what do they do with all that money? We know some of it, maybe, but we don't know what they did with it all. That's what makes it so interesting.
I would have to say there is another section in here that I find interesting that is part of what Cotton Malone is all about, and I liked it so much I wanted to be sure that we mentioned it. This is from the 26th chapter. He had read once that smart people exhibited 10 qualities: highly adaptable, understood what they didn't know, possessed an insatiable curiosity, read a lot, open-minded, liked their own company, had a high sense of self-control, were funny, sensitive to other people's experiences, and always, always thought creatively. He liked to think himself smart. I love this. This is as much of a description of Cotton Malone as anything that I've read in any of the other books. And isn't it? It's a wonderful way of saying if you have these qualities, that you're smart too. Because that's what helps you to be smart, is that you always want to know about other things and want to learn.
Yeah, that's the way he is. That's the way he is, and that's the way my readers are. My readers are the same way. They want to learn. They want to be. They want to expand. They want to know more about things. And this book's going to teach you a lot about some subjects that you may not know a whole lot about.
Absolutely. Well, the Bitcoin alone, like I said, is worth the price of the admission. But learning more about the CIA back in the early years, I've read bits and pieces of it and heard some of the lore, but I always wondered about Alan Dulles. It just seemed like he surely had a lot of misfires, that there were some successes, but even those came back to bite us.
He was terrible at what he did, and he influenced elections in Italy. He dealt with Iran. Mm-hmm. Set up the whole situation that eventually caused he brought the Shah and put him into power, which caused more problems down the road. He had just one failure after another failure. He was just not very good at what he did. The Bay of Pigs was another example. He thought, well, we're going to go in and invade Cuba and everyone will rise up and we'll get it done. And of course, nothing happened. It was a disaster. Finally, Kennedy fired him and got rid of him. And so, the CIA still went through that identity crisis even after that. And to this day, they still wrestle with it to some degree. Though I think today it's pretty much been established that the CIA is an information gathering agency today.
Yeah, that really probably should have been the mission statement all along.
That's what it was supposed to be, and that's what Truman wanted it to be. But Dulles had other ideas, and eventually he won out because Truman was gone, and Eisenhower let him do it.
Yeah. Eisenhower was a lot more of a cold warrior than he let on at the time. He had this persona of being a kindly, grandfatherly-like guy. How quickly people forgot that he was the mastermind behind the success of Operation Overlord, the D-Day invasion of Normandy, and the subsequent push into Germany.
He's a soldier. That's what he was.
Yeah, that's what he'd always been. And he was a good soldier.
He let Dulles go and let Dulles do what he wanted to do.
Yeah, and that might have been one of his few really big mistakes. He trusted people that didn't deserve his trust sometimes, and Dulles was one of them. I think he was impressed because the guy was smart, and he was, but that didn't mean he automatically knew how to do everything he was being told
Correct.
To do.
And Truman kept the CIA under control, but when he was gone, Dulles saw his opportunity and took it.
Is there anything about the Atlas Maneuver or about Cotton Malone that you were hoping I would ask you about and I didn't?
No, you did great. I hope readers will give him a try. And those of you who've never read me before, this is a good book to start with. You don't have to read my books in order, so you can start with this one and then pick up the others if you like. I think they could find out more about me and Cotton and all the books at my website. That's steveberry.org. Everything's there for them to find out.
Excellent. Well, I will say, Steve, that when I first started talking to you, that you were a new author to me, but certainly not to the rest of the world. And you're right. I then thought, okay, I'm my antenna are up now. I'm going to go looking for these other novels that are out there, and found quite a few of them. And as I've read them, I've realized, yeah, it's nice to read things in sequence, but it's not absolutely critical for to understand what's going on. And Cotton Malone is just a really fascinating character. It's not like there's 10 years worth of living between a book that you wrote 10 years ago and The Atlas Maneuver. Cotton hasn't gotten old and gray and feeble in that time.
No, I stopped aging Cotton a long time ago, so he will always be staring down 50, no more than that.
A wise decision, sir. Well, listen, thank you again for squeezing me in today after a long day of interviews. I really do appreciate it. Enjoyed your book so very much, and I'm really thrilled to encourage people to pick up a copy of it.
All right. Thank you for having me on. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. Take care. All right. Next Bye-bye. Time. We've been talking to Steve Barry, the author of The Atlas Maneuver, a Cotton Malone novel, the 18th of his Cotton Malone novels. It's from Grand Central, as are the others. He also has 5 standalone thrillers, 2 Luke Daniel adventures, and several works of short fiction, having sold over 26 million copies, translated into 41 languages. With his wife, Elizabeth, he is the founder of History Matters, an organization dedicated to historical preservation. He serves as an emeritus member of the Smithsonian Libraries Advisory Board and was a founding member of International Thriller Writers, formerly serving as its co-president. If you're looking for a great read, you won't enjoy any novel this year more than you'll enjoy the latest Cotton Malone novel, The Atlas Maneuver, from Steve Barry and Grand Central Publishing. Thanks so much for joining us today. Next week, we'll have another great author with us. Check out my podcast, if you will, on thebookshelf.podbean.com, and listen every week on the radio for us right here. Until next time, I'm your host, Dave Dockert. Thanks for listening, and God bless.